Orphan Black Season 4 is over, but we are just getting started here on Post Show Recaps. My name is Jessica Leese, and it has been a crazy, insane season here at Orphan Black, and here with me to break down everything that's happened all season long is the wonderful, inimitable Mike Bloom. Hello, Mike.
Hopefully I'm not inimitable. Hopefully they're not a bunch of Mike Bloom clones running around, though. I feel like Twitter is the place to make those fake accounts. So that's where Orphan Black's realities really become fervent.
So this is like Orphan Black Matrix mashup where people are just like the clones are now just like Twitter sock puppets.
Yeah, and Crystal knows Kung Fu. It all makes sense.
Yeah, it definitely. That was the linchpin right there.
Exactly. Crystal went into the Matrix for like half a season. She came back when they infiltrated Brightborn, and now she knows Kung Fu. It all makes sense now.
You know, Crystal is kind of the secret badass of the season when you think about it.
Yeah, she might. I mean, we'll definitely obviously dissect the season as a whole, but I think, you know, she's only made 3 guest appearances, but that might have been the perfect number in my opinion. She might have been one of my highlights for the season in general, which I didn't want to, you know, I don't think that speaks against the season at all. I just think they know how to use Crystal. They are not doing what they did with some of these clones in like seasons 2 and 3, where they feel like, oh, we need to use them. Let's shoehorn Crystal into like 7 episodes this season.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I had heard about Crystal was that she was supposed to have died when the first time we saw her with the caster clones, like kidnapping her. That was supposed to be the last time we saw her, but Tatiana got so into a character that everybody agreed that she had to come back, and that's why we ended up seeing so much of her, and that was more organic, I think, than, say, Tony.
Oh boy, I'm glad that we're past the days of Tony and that they never really acknowledge it again. I know, MK was, her backstory was revealed. I forget the name of, you know, the clone that she had made friends with who died in Helsinki, but we got a couple new clones and the addition of a Crystal brought more to the spotlight. But luckily, Tony is left vehemently on the side of the road as the car that is Orphan Black passes it by.
Yep, and it's fine, you know, if they want to mail him a little package of clone crud cure and he can go on and live his life, that would be fantastic, but we don't need to see it.
And you bring up an interesting point about, you know, Crystal being brought in for a few episodes this season, because I do feel like this might be the first season of Orphan Black where of our 4 main clones, you might include Rachel in there as well, especially after this past season. But if we're looking at Sarah, Helena, Allison, and Cosima, I feel like 2 of the 4 of them were really not involved in a good amount of the action. Helena especially, which is pretty crazy considering how pivotal she was in the first 3 seasons. To have her outright disappear for what, like 5 episodes is pretty crazy. One might chalk it up on a regular TV show to, oh, the actor was pregnant, so she had to go on maternity leave. But no, this is still the same actress, so there really is no excuse.
Yeah, she didn't get a DUI. She didn't get pregnant. She just kind of walked away, and that was a little bit strange to me as well.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what to feel about it, because I spoke before about how I'll use Hero Season 2 as an example. I think Season 1 was pretty much universally acclaimed, and then the creator had said in a press release, oh, like a comic book, we're going to have this idea of, oh, let's, you know, characters will go away and come back in future episodes. It'll be much more organic. But then, you know, they spoke to the network and sort of changed their minds and decided Siler is going to be a part of every single storyline from there on. And that's arguably when the show crashed and burned. But I feel like this show kind of took a turn from what they were doing before, kind of taking that hero's mentality of like, hey, we need to feature these 4 clones in some way, shape or form. They made a very bold choice, in my opinion, by saying like, OK, we're going to have arguably one of the biggest characters disappear for half the season. So, I mean, I missed her, but I didn't necessarily miss her kind of being brought in on stories that she really shouldn't be involved in. I'd rather have the writers utilize her and give her juicier material rather than sort of dissipate her material across several episodes that she has to be on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, what realistically was she going to do during that whole time? We got the great scene of her using Allison's, you know, Canadian health card to go get an ultrasound. And we got the ultrasound scene. What else do you do with a pregnant woman during the course of the season they would have to make it all about that. And I think this was a weird enough season for pregnant people that we didn't need to make it any weirder by having Helena's story shoehorned into the whole thing.
Definitely. You know, with the Brightborn stuff, that like Helena would become like the MacGuffin almost, that like Evie Cho would be after her. And you know, when she came back, she was back in full force. Turned out she'd been living in the middle of the woods. She puts that arrow right through that one EMS bad guy's neck before she attacks Allison. I will say, you know, the last time we saw her before that, that was a little sitcom-esque, in my opinion, the whole trope of like, oh, Helena overhears that Allison is, you know, bad-mouthing her on the phone, and so she decides to run away to not be a burden. Like, I saw that in like three episodes of Punky Brewster over the course of its run. So I don't know how strong that was, but I did like Helena coming back and her overall relationship with Allison, and at least her leaving kind of informed in what might be, in my opinion, one of the better episodes of the season, which was that episode with Sarah kind of being hesitant of Allison's true intentions when Donnie had been sent into prison and that there was a clear Neolution spy in there. And they were wondering, okay, you know, since Allison kind of has someone held hostage that's close to her, is she going to sell them out? Like, you know, arguably she might have done Helena, which really put a lot of tension between her and Sarah in the beginning of the season.
Yeah, and that was an interesting thing to see because we've not seen them as divided. Like, Allison has spent a lot of time off on her own, but we've never seen them like really pitted against each other like that. And that was, it was interesting to watch the long con unfold, I guess.
Yeah, that entire episode, which, I mean, I don't know how much doubt I really had because, you know, Allison might be naive sometimes or sometimes a little over her head when dealing with the drug dealing stuff, especially from last season. But, you know, she's a pretty tough cookie. And so even though there might have been some conflict between her and Sarah, I really didn't expect her to really sell her entire clone-based organization out to Detective Duco just so Donnie could survive one night in prison.
Yeah, it seems like even Donnie can probably deal with one night in prison.
Did this prepare you adequately for your Orange is the New Black coverage on post-show recaps?
I was just thinking, like, Donnie couldn't survive a night in that prison.
Yeah, how much more extreme did this prison look than Litchfield?
It looked like it had about the same amount of supervision, which is to say none.
I mean, do you think it was the same level considering that Donnie was a drug dealer, which is, spoiler alert, basically, you know, what like Alex Voss gets caught for doing. So theoretically, they would be on the same level in the prison system.
Yeah, maybe. But Donnie was also kind of in the equivalent of county lockup for the weekend, because he hadn't actually been charged with anything. Like, you don't end up going to prison until you've been found guilty of something, I think.
Yeah. I mean, this probably segues too into Allison and Donnie talk, which, you know, I feel like we're going in like increasing order of airtime in terms of these clone characters, because even though, you know, Allison and Donnie did have a couple moments of prominence, I think, like you said before, they were still, it was a little bit of the same old song in terms of Allison and Donnie are kind of doing their own thing. Now they're sort of dealing with the repercussions of their dealings from last season, and you know, it intersects a couple times. Detective Duco is really the key transition piece between them, and I know Allison and Donnie get to interact with the Brightborn stuff a little bit. I know the leaky stuff was like the first thing on the table, right, once we came back in episode two.
Yeah, and that actually brings me to one of the things that I find irritating about the series in general. And I guess, you know, we can talk a little bit more about how we feel about next season being the last season, but it certainly feels to me like every season it's like, well, here's a bad guy, and let's go find the bad guy, and let's defeat the bad guy. Oh, but this bad guy was working for a different bad guy who's even badder. So the following season, we spend the whole season getting that bad guy, and oh, wait, no, that bad guy turns out to be some other bad guy is pulling his strings, and it's just like turtles all the way down, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I would compare it to like a video game almost, in that you think you're fighting the big boss halfway through the game, but oh no, it turns out that there's even a bigger boss with even more experience to give. This season took an interesting turn though, and I think we talked about this either in our season premiere recap or last season's finale recap, with the idea of going back to Neolution as an enemy, considering that they were pretty much the big bads, Licky specifically, and as later revealed to be Rachel in season one. Season two was more so about, you know, the Neolutionists versus the
Prolethians.
Prolethians, that's what it was, with Gracie. Everyone's favorite storyline. Season three was all about the casters, everyone's other favorite storyline. And then we say, okay, now we're going back to Neolution. Susan Duncan's back. And then, like you said, there's a little bit of a nesting boss egg here in that it turns out that Neolution isn't even the problem. Evie Cho and Brightborn is the problem.
Yeah, and it turns out Evie Cho and Brightborn, we got them out of the way, and now it's P.T. Westmoreland that's the problem.
Yes, famed circus owner P.T. Westmoreland.
Well, there's a sucker born every minute, and all of those suckers have gone to watch Orphan Black.
Yeah, or all the suckers have clones.
Yes, there's a clone sucker born every minute.
Yeah, so what did you think about that? I mean, so I think we were both, like, interested in this idea of going back to Neolution. This, I think we talked in our season premiere about, generally, this felt like, I wouldn't say back to basics, but there was a lot of hearkening back to the first season, and I'm assuming we'll talk a little bit more about expounding on the Beth storyline that the first half of this season did later on. But that being said, I mean, were you happy to see that Evie Cho was behind it? Were you a little confused? I mean, she did pass, you know, our name test theory. She was introduced in the first episode. We thought, let's keep an eye on her. But I didn't expect her to be the big bad of this. I mean, it turned out to be like three episodes overall, but still.
Yeah, I expected that there was something more. It turned out Neolution wasn't even really the problem. They were just kind of half of the problem, and the other half was really Brightborn. I did enjoy, like, revisiting some of those season one throwbacks. Like, I liked going back to the club, and I liked the idea that there's all these, this, like, subculture of people devoted to this idea who all have, like, secret clone implants. And then, I don't know how I felt about the end being, like, bots versus clones. That seemed a little bit cheap to me.
Yeah, that was weird. We should probably talk about the bots thing, too, because, you know, we got a hint of it in the first episode that, you know, Beth had been shown that video of a bot being inside some guy's cheek, I think. And then I'd say, like, the first half of the season until the big Evie Cho reveal is basically Sarah and everyone trying to figure out, what are these bots do? They found one in Leaky's deposing corpse as well. I'm trying to remember at least what the bots really were. Was it anything outside of just basic gene therapy?
It was gene therapy, and I thought that was kind of a weird departure from what we thought Neolution was before, which was just people, like, getting weird things added onto their bodies. Like, you had a guy with a tail, and then the corpse they find in the first episode has apparently two sets of genitals, and I thought it was kind of one of those things. I guess the bots must have been driving that somehow, but you also had a lot of people that didn't appear to have any kind of weird genetic enhancements.
And I will say, I've voiced before that I'm not a fan of gore on TV, and I think for the most part, we strayed away from that. There were a couple. I mean, the aforementioned moment where Helena shot the arrow through the guy's neck in the second to last episode was a little gruesome, but I could not watch that dentist scene happened. I forget if it was like episode three or four, but when Sarah goes undercover as Beth to really figure out what's going on with the bots, and that woman offers to remove it. And yeah, it was between that and then Cosima, after Kendall Malone dies, goes into that depression and she, like, bites her cheek so hard to create an incision to put the bot in. It was just, we had predicted that the whole storyline of, oh, let's put things in and out of our face would not be a good look. And it held true to that theory.
Yeah, it definitely was not a good look. It was really, I think there's also something impractical about installing just, like, what is basically amounts to a self-destruct button in everybody's face. That seems like a really strange and poorly thought out plan because, you know, how many times have you been eating something and you accidentally bit the inside of your cheek?
Yeah, exactly. And then to just have, like, a little worm crawl out instead, that'd be quite the surprise. You have pizza burn on the roof of your mouth, and then you also have a bot crawling around in there as well.
Yeah. And then just, like, eats your whole face like the guy in the video. Really, I would, if I knew I had one of those things in my mouth, I would be on oatmeal for, like, the rest of my life.
Exactly. I'd go on Big Brother slop.
Exactly.
So I guess going back to Evie Cho for a second, I mean, in terms of the Brightborn stuff, I'm also trying to remember here because, you know, this took place over the course of 10 weeks overall. So in terms of the interaction between Brightborn and Neolution, was Brightborn a separate company that was sort of working together with Neolution, or was it under Neolution and then Evie kind of just had a coup d'etat and took over the company?
Well, there was like, at one point, they showed us a table that had like all the different corporations, and it showed you where Brightborn was in the pecking order. It was like a subsidiary that was, you know, tangentially related to Neolution, but it was really its own like legitimized LLC thing, I guess. It was a lot like looking at that 30 Rock chart with the Shinehart wig company.
Yes, exactly. I can't wait for Brightborn, now that it's been taken over, to become a subsidiary of GE and have to have Jack Donaghy come management. Is that what Ivan Van Leer is? He's the Jack Donaghy of Orphan Black?
He's totally the Jack Donaghy, and it's totally like a Cabletown subsidiary now.
That's fantastic. I like that comparison. If only to have Alec Baldwin appear in season 5. Make that happen, guys. But yeah, again, I'll say like Evie Cho kind of becoming this rise to power, I think the problem I had with it, I didn't mind the surprise of it, because I think we were actually talking on Twitter about this after our season premiere recap. Someone had asked us, like, is Orphan Black better on a binge or on a week-to-week watch? And I would argue the binge, because a season of Orphan Black almost plays out like a 10-hour thriller movie with a lot of twists and turns. And I think, you know, had you watched these all back-to-back, maybe Evie Cho would ring a lot more true to you, considering that, like, she had made an appearance like 3 episodes ago, and now she's suddenly a big character. I think my problem with her becoming a big bad is just we really knew nothing about her. We had known about her past with, you know, she had shingles. She was actually still showing signs of shingles, I guess. And she kind of had a grudge to bear on the world in terms of making people perfect and really curing people of their diseases, or at the same time curing them of all abnormalities in general, whatever that may be. But when it says like, mwahaha, I am suddenly the big villain of the season, I'm sort of like, okay, that's great. I don't really know you though.
Yeah. It's like, who are you again?
Exactly. Like, does she even go here?
Yeah. She doesn't even go here. You know, she can take her puppies and rainbows elsewhere. But I think it's a really good point that in a well-written TV series or a well-written film, the bad guy believes that they are the good guy and that they are doing the right thing. They're terrible shows, terrible movies. The bad guy is always like, I'm just here to be bad, and like, I want these people killed because I don't like them. And the bad guy always feels like he's got the moral high ground in something where you are really invested, like when there's complexity and when there's characters with depth. That's one of the biggest signs. And I didn't get that from Evie Cho. I just got like, she had a grudge against the world. Things weren't going well for her, so she wanted to destroy all the clones.
Yeah, and she was, once the big reveal was made, like, she seemed pretty mysterious in the time that we got to know her. And then once the big reveal was made, she pretty much turned into like a stereotypical villain, where, you know, she was extremely angry and malevolent the entire time we saw her. That being said, she fell pretty much as quickly as she rose in this season. Yeah. And that, you know, like episode 9 was really her big bring down episode. And she was basically brought down by candid camera almost, in Rachel wearing the secret necklace and having Evie admit on that camera that she was euthanizing some of the Brightborn babies because they were showing abnormalities.
Isn't this basically how like every Adam Sandler movie ends, where someone gets a video of the bad guy talking about how bad he is and then they broadcast it for everybody?
Yeah, pretty much. Or like, you know, something like, I don't know, I feel like Heavyweights, the Ben Stiller movie, has like a climax like this as well, right? That like, I think they were like secretly filming, like Dwight Goodman was making his, I just called him Ben Stiller's character from Dodgeball, but same difference, where he had been making like a documentary, but they had actually been filming B-roll footage that shows how horrible they were treating him. They showed it during Parents Day, and that's how he got chased out of the camp.
Yep, and it's the end of Mallrats.
I like how we're just like bringing up all these movies that this trope is associated with. Yeah, it was a little strange. Now, Jess, I have to ask you, in terms of all this Brightborn stuff, you aren't expecting mother to be. Did anything hit too close to home for you in terms of all this, you know, gene therapy in utero stuff?
This was a really messed up season to watch while being pregnant. I'm just going to throw that right out there.
I could imagine.
Like, I really did not need to see a baby born with a hole where its face should be and then immediately watch that baby get euthanized.
Yeah, that was pretty rough for, I think, anybody to watch, but especially to have that on the mind or on the stomach, I guess, in your case, is not very good to have that be a prominent storyline. And, you know, I feel like this came to prominence really in like the middle part of the season when they figure out what Brightborn is. We do have the fun scene of, you know, Donnie and Felix trying to pose as the couple and Cosima later as the surrogate. But then once we kind of get past all those fun and games, and we find out what Brightborn is really about, it gets a lot scarier.
It really does. And I just want to reassure the public, like, here's where the science of Orphan Black, the one time it hasn't rung true for me. You'd be able to tell whether your baby had a face or not on the ultrasound. Like, mine has a face. I know that. I've seen it. They should be doing way more ultrasounds. There's not enough oversight of these pregnant women with their, like, messed up gene therapy. I'm just putting that out there.
Unless they have, like, a stock photo that they just sort of put up there, you know, like on a Fisher-Price playset, how they have, like, oh, a sticker of a done turkey in the microwave. Like, oh, guess your baby looks fine just now, just like it looked the same way 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that must be how they're running it. Like, you know, their ultrasound machine's been broken for 3 years and nobody's bothered to repair it.
Exactly. They've been spending all their money on PR. They really can't afford the actual technology behind it.
Yeah, it's true. PR and, like, face worms.
I do feel like we actually probably glossed over a lot of Allison and Donnie stuff with this Brightborn trail that we went down. So I do want to get back to them for a couple seconds. I mean, I do have to acknowledge, as a musical theater lover, Tatiana Maslany singing Jesus Christ Superstar. Ah, I love it. We got a break from it in season three when she tried at least. We got like 2 seconds of her singing in season two before she fell off the stage. So I was happy to see Tatiana Maslany sing full out Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah, that was fantastic. I was never a musical theater person. I did play in the pit for Jesus Christ Superstar, though. So very close to my heart. And I don't know how I felt about, you know, Allison's return to Jesus. That was a little bit... You know, we could have spent that time on other things, I think.
Yeah, it was a weird kind of place to go. I mean, I honestly thought it was going to pay off. My biggest bet that I had going was that the pastor, there was something behind him, whether he was an Eolutionist or he was working for another organization. Maybe they went back to Dyad again by the end of this season. But he just, I don't know, he looked a little too caring, but I guess that's, you know, I guess that was Allison's arc this season, considering that even in the finale, in the extended scene, which again is weird, talking about characters that sort of got the shaft, Allison wasn't even in the season finale except for this extended scene where she says, like, Helena saved me, you know, I will come at him with the power of Jesus.
Yeah, and then her absence was explained for the rest of the episode that, you know, she'd eaten some bad deer stew.
Which, again, is weird because it's the same actress.
Yeah, how, you know, if it was any other actress, you'd be like, what did she do to piss off the director?
Yeah, what movie was she filming that she had to skip out on the last episode of the season?
Yeah, and they explain it away with something so gross and awful. And
yeah.
But they could have gotten her on screen for, you know, the 30 seconds. So I don't know.
Yeah, I would say her literal come to Jesus moments, the Jesus Christ Superstar one, and again, I might be biased, but that one paid off because, you know, she's singing Judas's song, arguably my favorite song in the show, Superstar. And, you know, that has a lot of poignancy because the big question of that episode, which we had spoken about before, was Allison going to be the Judas? Was she going to sell out Sarah and the rest of Clone Club to protect her husband? It turns out she doesn't, so she can unironically sing her ass off about it. The rest of it afterwards, again, I wasn't entirely sure about where they were going with it. I will say another highlight that I did like of the Allison and Donnie stuff was the episode beforehand when they had their daughter's birthday party and the, you know, I'm a big fan when it's not used too much of the trope of like the ironic happy music played over slow motion shots of horrible things happening. So to have, you know, Donnie tell the scary story and then have it be interrupted by the cops busting in and smashing all the party supplies and cake and then arresting Donnie, I thought that was actually really well done.
Yeah, and it sent all those kids to therapy for the next decade to come.
I mean, these kids also live in the neighborhood where, like, their neighbor also, like, got brutally murdered a couple of seasons ago. There's drugs rampant in the neighborhood. There's a lot of stuff going on. I'm surprised people haven't moved out at this point.
That's true. Property values must be going into the toilet.
Yeah, definitely. Even with a city council person on the board.
Yep. Yep. Very true.
So I guess we should get to Cosima a little bit. And Cosima had a weird arc because she's sick again. And I'm not saying like sick again as in like a relapse. I think the show just kind of did away with that storyline for one season last season, because for some reason they wanted to focus on the love triangle between her, Delphine, and Shay. Were you happy that there was no sign of Shay at all this season?
I was happy there was no sign of either one of them this season. Like, we got a little bit of Delphine in the finale, and then it was pretty much like we've stayed off of everybody's love life all season. And I think the show as a whole was stronger for that. But I think Cosima learned a few really valuable lessons this season. Chief among them, always make your own personal backups of everything.
It was interesting, this whole choice in the mid-season, where we talked before about, you know, there's pretty much all happens in over the course of like 10 minutes when we figure out A, Evie Cho is behind everything. B, Evie Cho betrayed Sarah Duncan and decided to kill Kendall Malone. C, they kind of, you know, did the touchdown dance by also destroying all the information that Cosima and Scott had gathered over the past 3 years. And to have Cosima be the one to experience that, because, I mean, she's probably the only clone so far that really had not seen a lot of time on the battlefield. She had pretty much been like the tech person of the team, kind of working behind the scenes and letting people know what was going on behind the computer. So to have her be the first witness to Kendall's ultimate death, I mean, it has a lot of ripples in her psyche. Even the next episode, when, as I mentioned before, she decides, like, as sort of her own penance, she's going to put the bot inside her, which is a big moment. Luckily, Felix saves her just in time. That's an episode where, like, Felix saves multiple clones at once without even realizing it. But there was a lot of change going on with her character, which I was happy about, because, you know, I'd rather have her go through this entire rigmarole than have her just be the generic tech person who also has a terminal disease.
Yeah, it's true. She needed some evolution, because I think I get the sense that the writers don't frequently know exactly what to do with her. And so they just kind of make her into, you know, that guy on the Ocean's 11 team who messes with the cameras.
You know, she's like Chloe from 24. She's working in a safe bunker somewhere and is always transmitting information to the people that are actually in danger. And to have her actually be in danger for, you know, first it was that little period with Kendall, but then her making the choice to go to the island, which I'm sure we'll talk about, I think was very poignant towards a character that would probably not even do that as soon as last season.
Yeah, and she's the only one who could, and there was a really good place for her to step up and do something. And I'm really impressed with the fact that she came up with the cure twice, basically.
Yeah, she literally reinvented the wheel, it seems. And that, yeah, she had to start from ground zero, yet, you know, I'm assuming with the technology in Susan Duncan's lab and probably a little bit of her help, she was able to do so. Though, of course, she was double-crossed.
Well, trusting Rachel was just a bad plan to begin with.
Definitely. Speaking towards Delphine, we did see, you know, I'll admit I'm probably not the biggest Delphine person. Maybe it was just because I was a little soured by, again, that entire, like, Shay or Delphine storyline from last season. Her return, I'm a little meh on. You know, if it gets Cosima happiness, I'm happy for that. But in terms of, like, storyline relevance, I don't know if it really holds water.
Yeah, I have never actually been the greatest Delphine fan. I'm not a Del fan. I think the two of them together are great. They have great chemistry. And like you said, when Cosima's happy, I'm happy. But from the first moment that Delphine was introduced, and of course, this is the moment after we find out that every clone has their own monitor, and it's crystal clear to the viewer that Delphine's being introduced to be Cosima's monitor. And it's like, how do you trust her? How do you ever trust her, even when it becomes apparent that her feelings are genuine? And then she does double-cross Cosima a number of times, and they keep finding each other, they keep coming back to each other, they clearly have real feelings for each other, but boy, I can't ever fully give my heart over to Delphine.
Yeah, I mean, I would say what you just said about Delphine could also have been said about Paul as well. I feel like of our three monitors, Delphine, Paul, and Donnie, I think Donnie's the only one that really successfully completely won us all over with the fact that he had been spying on his wife and monitoring her activities for the past God knows how many years. Because, you know, and Paul might have done himself a little justice as well with his sacrifice and him actually revealing that, like, he did love Sarah all along. Absence did not make the heart grow fonder with Delphine for me. And it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure we'll talk later about what we might think season five will hold. And I'm assuming Delphine will play a much bigger part in the whole Westmoreland thing than we initially thought.
Yeah. And I really need to find out, why did she get saved? Like, why did she get, like, bundled off into the van? That doesn't make any sense to me at this moment. And I'm looking forward to getting another piece of that puzzle.
Yeah. So I'm going to start, like, I just want to keep, like, jumping around characters.
Sure,
here.
Absolutely.
I want to talk a little bit about MK, because MK was really a big presence in the first half of this season. But after the whole Ferdinand Helsinki incident was revealed and her backstory was revealed as a result, she disappeared except for, like, maybe one episode. So, you know, we saw MK in the first episode. We were very intrigued by this, you know, Bjork, almost childlike clone. What did you think about her, I wouldn't say growth pattern, but at least her pattern throughout the season and what we ultimately discovered about her?
MK is basically the clone with the dragon tattoo, right?
Yeah, basically. She's great with technology. She's got a European accent of indeterminate origin. And yeah, she is all into gruesome forms of revenge.
Yeah, and really, I feel like she stepped into the role that, you know, Cosima was evolving, so we needed to have another clone to, like, sit in the background and yell enhance at the screen.
Exactly. So remind me a little bit, because this was all the way back, I think, in, like, episode 4 that we found out exactly what Helsinki was and why MK has it out for Ferdinand and Topside. So I guess Helsinki was pretty much a plan to just nuke all the European clones. And MK had formed a friendship with another clone whose name I am completely forgetting, unfortunately. But she had been killed. I guess there was a fire, a car accident that burst into flames. And MK escaped. And I think we talked in our preview, like, okay, something's underneath her bangs. And it turns out that those were significant burn marks. And that was really the scar that she bears from the incident.
Yeah, she was traumatized, and it was one of these things, like, the clones were becoming self-aware, and they needed to get rid of all of the clones before what happened here in Canada would happen to them. So it was basically, she befriended another clone, and they didn't really think a lot of it at first. It looked like, oh yeah, we'll be best friends because we look exactly alike, and we can borrow each other's clothes.
Yeah, that won't be suspicious whatsoever.
Yeah, it's interesting, and we can get into this more in a minute, like, how each one of the clones has reacted to learning they are a clone, and some of them are just like, hey, let's be best friends, and some of them are like, you're not as hot as me, so we can't really be clones.
Yeah, one in particular reaction to that was great, but yeah, that was a pretty brutal revenge strategy on MK's part, to basically try to make Ferdinand burst into flames was pretty graphic. But you know, luckily Sarah, as always, comes through to save the day, even though MK comes out of the incident much richer, and she got to see Ferdinand covered in blood begging for his life.
And you know, Ferdinand was secretly getting off on that.
Oh, definitely. This man has very many weird quirks. I was trying to remember, we see him again in the finale, and he was this the first outright Rachel Ferdinand scene we had seen, or did we see something in season 3 as well? Because I know Sarah had posed as Rachel, but I'm trying to remember if the two of them had actually had any bedroom scenes in season 3.
I don't remember if they did. I don't think they did. I think it was more that Sarah guessed what their dynamic was and played it as if she was Rachel and figured out pretty quickly what Ferdinand was into.
Yeah, which we got to see a little bit of it. And I was trying to figure out in this scene in the finale, like, was Rachel trying to get one over on him? And it appears not. It just appears that, you know, that's the type of thing that they're into.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nice to see some, you know, consensual kink portrayed, you know, without judgment. But I didn't need to see that much of it.
No, definitely not. I mean, again, if I know Orphan Black is more basic cable, but if it aired on even bluer cable networks, I'm sure there would have been much more stuff that was shown. And maybe even an extended episode about the sex life of Ferdinand and Rachel.
Oh, God. Yeah, if this was Game of Thrones, like, forget it.
Yeah. Ferdinand and Rachel make a porno. Coming soon in the Orphan Black offseason.
Yeah, that's going to be on the DVD extras.
What did you think, going back to MK, about the choice to bring her back for one episode? I mean, did you think it was necessary? What did you... I know we'll talk about season five later on, but is MK going to become a Crystal or a Tony in season five, in your opinion?
I would guess that MK... We don't really know what to do with her at this point. I think we're going to see her next season, but I think it's going to be more along the lines of, we need to find out some computer things. Who do we know who knows computer things? We have a clone. I don't think she's going to be inducted into the Sestrahood, but I also don't see her becoming someone we want to see in that role.
Yeah, I don't think she's taking part in the clone dance party that I'm sure will close out season five.
Yeah, but I could see Crystal being there.
Oh, Crystal is going to be twerking away.
Yeah, Crystal's totally, she's going to be shaking it.
So let's separate ourselves from clones a little bit and talk a little bit about some of our more secondary characters here. Felix undergoes a very interesting change, at least for the first like half of this season. When Sarah comes back from Iceland, he has very much like separated himself from her emotionally. And it turns out that I think him dealing with all this clone stuff had really questioned his own thoughts about where he came from, because he was adopted as well by S. And so he reaches out, and through, you know, other genetics websites, he's able to find that he has a half sister named Adele. Jess, were you a Adele fan?
I really could have taken or left Adele in the beginning, because it sure seemed to me like this had to be some kind of topside Neolutionist brightborn mole. Like, it seemed so obvious to me, and then it turned out she was just really messed up and pretty much female Felix. She grew on me over time.
Do you like this idea? Because we mentioned it a few times of like, Orphan Black, I think, has bred in us a paranoia to think, oh, this character in the corner is going to betray them. Oh, this recently introduced character is going to betray them. Do you think that that's just sort of the nature of the genre? Or do you like getting to sit down and think who's going to turn on who next?
I like it. And I especially like it when they almost make you think someone that you've known forever is going to do it, like what they did with Alice in this season. But in this case, it felt like, yeah, it was interesting to feel the paranoia kind of growing and growing, and then it kind of didn't go anywhere. And that meant to me that, like, not everybody's going to betray everybody. Like, sometimes we're going to not see it coming at all.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you were probably feeling the same thing as Sarah was during those couple of episodes, when she was just like, I don't know if she was territorial or jealous, but she was not approving of Adele. She was not Adele fan whatsoever. And, you know, it came together in that really tense dinner scene where Felix and Sarah came at odds, and I couldn't tell. So Sarah had submitted to Scott Adele's genes to figure out if they were related, and I guess they were, though for a second I thought that Sarah, they actually weren't, and Sarah had just made it up to make Felix feel better. But I guess I had gone too many levels too deep. Maybe that was the paranoia bred in my own psyche from this show.
Yeah, I think you were overthinking it. I think it turned out that it was exactly what it appeared to be on the surface, just because, you know, if I don't think Sarah would have lied to keep a rando in the picture for longer. She wouldn't have done that, because if this person is a mole, she needs to get them out of the picture.
Yeah. So I guess her sisters are number one. So I feel like she would sacrifice Felix's feelings almost to, you know, keep the clone club still going. So even after that, I mean, Adele becomes Donnie's lawyer for a hot sec.
Yeah, we need to talk about that.
All right, yeah, lay it on me. What did you think about those couple of scenes when Adele served as his counsel?
We need to talk about how an attorney that got disbarred in Texas or wherever the hell she's from for, you know, being a total lush.
Yeah, some southern state. It might have been Georgia, actually.
I don't remember. The accent felt really fake, which, you know, that was my inner Sarah Manning kind of pinging on that. But she can go up to Toronto and practice law in Canada after being disbarred in the United States. Like, that seemed implausible to me, but I guess she was just giving, like, a little bit of advice that would work on both sides of the border.
Yeah, the fact that she was able to very easily vacate one country and take up residence in another is very suspicious. And almost like Shay, it would have been interesting to find out a little bit more about Adele had she had more prominence to the plot, which in the end, again, even though we had sort of thought that she would, that she'd be, you know, a mole, she really did turn out not to be. She just turned out to be almost a red shirt in that capacity. And so when Felix kind of realized that she was in too deep, he decides to cut the cord himself.
Yeah, which I think that brought an interesting conundrum to Felix, because he had to decide where his loyalties really were. And I think it was a really smart idea to give him some background this season, because that gave him something to do when he wasn't in the thick of the clone drama. But then when he got pulled back in, he had to ultimately realize who his real family really was.
When are they going to give Felix a boyfriend?
I don't know, man. I loved it when he was hooking up with the morgue guy. Can we bring back the morgue guy?
Yeah, I feel like that's like what I want for, you know, screw give Elsa a girlfriend. Give Felix a boyfriend. Just because that can make things interesting. I think unlike some of the other random relationships that happen on this show, I feel like Felix really deserves it, and it could add an interesting wrinkle. Maybe they try to like test the waters a little bit by saying, let's have Felix interact with people outside of the Clone Club and see how that goes over with Adele. So maybe, you know, it's their last season. Maybe they'll throw whatever they want to at the wall, and Felix will end up happy with somebody.
Yeah. And, you know, we had a nice break from all the love life drama. But even Sarah got some action this season.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about this guy, Dizzy, because I'm still not sure how to feel about him. So he's not a Neolutionist, but he just sort of like hangs around that club, right? And he's just really interested and very knowledgeable in the stuff that's going on.
I couldn't tell if he was or not. I don't know how deep he was in. Deep enough to know some stuff, but not so deep that he's got his own self-destruct button, I guess.
I guess so, though. He almost showed signs of Cal as well, in that he seemed like really good with computers, too.
Yeah, it was like Cal is off in Essos, you know, with Jorah Mormont, so we can't get him back this season. So we'll just bring in some other guy with a beard to bang Sarah and know a lot about.
With both shows coming to an end soon, what do you think the chances are that we'll see Cal back on the show?
I think Cal will be on for like one episode next season.
Well, because what did they say in the second episode, I think, of season four? Or was like he'd been like out doing something when MK called Sarah and said, get your stuff, we're leaving.
Yeah, so he's just going to come back to a burned out Hulk.
Yeah, like this poor man had holed himself up in Iceland for more than the time that Sarah and S had and Kendall had been there. He'd probably made a big home for himself, probably had ran an entire business outside of this home in Iceland, and now it just was gone while he went out to take a piss.
Yeah, they send him out on a skier run and he comes back and everything's burned to the ground.
So, yeah, Dizzy kind of came and went. I mean, I know Sarah kind of went on that bender in like episode 6 or 7 after Kendall's death, where she kind of says, screw Clone Club, I'm kind of out on my own. And, you know, they almost hook up finally. But I'm really trying to think about, like, were there any other significant Dizzy moments this season?
Not really. He was kind of a non-starter.
Yeah. I mean, do you think he's going to make a big prominent appearance in season 5? I mean, he's an ally to Clone Club. He's Clone Club adjacent, I guess, in that he doesn't really know about anyone else, but he's someone that Sarah can call upon, who's sort of like in the inner circle of the groundlings of the Neolutionists.
She will need to go back in there at some point, I'm sure, because that club is just too much fun not to ever go back to it. And I could see him being like pissed off that he never called her again.
Yeah, what did you think about like the random band that was playing that one episode where Sarah went on a bender?
Oh, that wasn't a random band. That was actually somebody quite famous, I think.
Oh, who was it?
It was Peaches.
Okay, I've heard of Peaches before, and not just the fruit that might grow in Adele's home state. We're still not sure at this point. Yeah, I thought I recognized them at some point. I mean, I'm assuming they were of some prominence, but it was interesting that they, you know, outside of S singing a song last season, there aren't outright musical performances in Orphan Black. And so that was interesting. And we sort of counteracted that with Sarah having presumably a three-way in the bathroom.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
Definitely.
But, you know, good for Sarah. Yeah, get it, girl.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm assuming she had not been getting action for a while, even though, you know, Cal was away in Iceland and she had other stuff to deal with. So this was really a treat yourself episode. Probably not all treat yourself day's end, though, and trying to throw yourself onto the train tracks.
No, that kind of took a sharp turn. And, you know, we got to thank the ghost of Beth for getting her out of that.
I want to talk about Beth. I think that's a perfect segue, because we had spoken after the first episode, which was entirely, except for the last scene, a Beth flashback. And I think we kind of disagreed about whether or not this was a one-time thing or if we would see more Beth. And it turned out to be the latter, so much so that Art and Sarah were pretty much following Beth's footprints for the first 4 or 5 episodes of this season.
Yeah, I thought that was a really clever way. I liked all of the shout-outs to season 1, because season 1 was really, it was so strong. It was such a great entree. And I feel like seasons 2 and 3 kind of were on the downswing. And they needed to go back and think about, like, what were the things that made the show interesting to begin with? And go to those things. And I think having Beth be their logical lead into that was a really inspired idea.
Yeah, I think this show in general, even though season 4 had some questionable stuff with Evie Cho and Adele as an example, but at the end of the day, I think after season 3, the creators realized, like, crap, we got so turned around in following this random map that we are so far from our home base that our fans love. Let's go back to the warmth and coziness of our home base. Let's have Delphine cuddle up next to us to keep us warm. And let's go back to that feeling that season 1 really gave us. And I feel like we got a lot of old school vibes from this season, which in general felt nice. I would say I'm trying to figure out whether this beat season 2, in my opinion, but it's a step in the right direction from season 3.
Yeah, it was definitely, I enjoyed this season a lot more than I enjoyed season 3, I think.
Yeah, because I think season 3, I don't know if it was ambition or just misdirection, but I think they just tried to do too many things that Orphan Black really wasn't. Whereas here, they kind of went back to, let's talk about the Lita clones. Let's see what's going on with them. Let's try to have them duel with, you know, their old nemesis, the Neolutionist, which actually speaks towards Rachel Duncan, who was set up as the main antagonist for the end of season 1 and throughout all of season 2. Season 3 kind of left her a little catatonic. She's still a little catatonic in season 4, though eventually, you know, she gets brought to the island. She learns to get her faculties about her just in time to see weird things through her robot eye. But I think the most interesting component of Rachel's storyline this season is her relationship with her mother, who has now come out of hiding to interact with her.
And I feel like this is a plot device you can only use so many times on any show. Like, you veer into soap opera territory probably the third time you have somebody that everybody thinks is dead turn out to not be dead.
Were there diminishing returns with Susan Duncan, considering that we had seen Ethan Duncan do almost the same thing 2 seasons prior?
Yeah, it felt very diminishing returns. Like, okay, I don't really actually care that Susan Duncan is still alive. That doesn't seem like much of a shocker, given that Ethan Duncan was also still alive.
Yeah, even though it seemed like Ethan Duncan, Susan Duncan definitely wore the pants in that relationship, right? It seems like Ethan Duncan seemed like a generally nice man, whereas Susan Duncan kind of came in there. She might have arguably been one of the big bads for the first half of the season as well, before the Evie Cho reveal, saying, you know, oh, I've kidnapped Rachel, I have this plan to eliminate all the clones, you know. And but once, if we figure out that, oh no, you know, Evie's kind of gone rogue and splintered out away from her, she's not exactly on the same side as Clone Club, but they at least have a tenuous alliance until in the last episode when she decides to lock Cosima in that room.
And again, I don't know what Cosima was expecting.
Yeah, exactly. You fell for the oldest trick in the book.
Yeah, well, you know, the second oldest, you know, never get involved in land war in Asia.
And then never trust Neolutionists when they offer you a deal.
Exactly, exactly.
When death is on the line.
Yeah, and death was certainly on the line there.
Speaking towards Susan as well, what did you think about Ira? We were intrigued because we were like, okay, Ari Millen's back. We don't see any Ari Millen. We pretty much think all the caster clones are either dead or gone in the case of Mark. Here we have Ira, some rando caster who I guess Susan got to keep as a pet as a result of her work on the project. And he just sort of, I don't know, he kind of seemed a little blasé to me in terms of personality, but maybe that was the point.
Yeah, it was kind of like, oh, wow, can I keep the most boring clone so I can have sex with him sometimes?
Yeah, that was weird, too.
It was so weird.
Yeah, Dustin Hoffman is suing for intellectual licensing after watching that pool scene.
Yeah, that was really, That was something. I mean, yeah, Susan Duncan, go get some, but it's a little creepy when you consider that she basically grew him in a lab and raised him for that purpose.
Exactly. Don't rock the cradle, Susan. Don't rock the test tube.
Yeah, he seemed like, especially, I think it's really apparent whenever somebody who is not Tatiana Maslany is playing a clone, it's really apparent how talented she is. Like, Ari Millen, he does okay, but I felt like last season, especially, his attempts to play all these different personalities really felt forced, and it didn't feel like any of them was really an amazing breakout character, and I felt the same way about Ira.
Yeah, I think that's the problem as well. I think, as you said, Ari Millen does a pretty good job, but I think you can only do so much with what you're written, and considering that all these caster boys were raised together, they're all pretty much going to have the same personality, except for Rudy, who's a little bit more of the Helena type. But Ira is like a complete blank wall in terms of personality, which, you know, works sometimes. It was fun to see him in the finale walk in on Rachel and Ferdinand and then end up in that situation. But well, we left him like as a hostage with Art and Felix, and now we pretty much don't know where he is, but that's okay.
Yeah, he's the C-3PO of the show.
Oh my, is he going to come back with a red arm next season?
He's totally going to come back with a red arm.
No, they're just not going to explain it whatsoever.
Right, right.
I like that. Yeah, it was weird. I don't know why they felt like they had to include casters in there. The only reason I could imagine so is, again, once Evie kind of torched all the stuff that they had been doing, Cosima comes up with this idea of, oh, let's use Sarah's cells and we'll use Iris sperm to, you know, recreate Kendall Malone's combination of both to sort of jumpstart the project. But outside of that, he really has had no prominence on this show.
Yeah, boy, isn't it a lucky break that all the caster clones plumbing works, even if the Lita clones plumbing doesn't.
Yeah, the Lita clones aren't glitching, so I guess, you know, it's half dozen in one hand, six in the other, and a swan head in a third hand that glitched as well. Speaking of Kendall, were you surprised to see her become kind of a character in the first half of the season before she gets killed off?
Yeah, it seemed like she had a pretty complicated relationship with her daughter, and I was surprised that she would get kind of enveloped in the fold so thoroughly.
Yeah, I totally expected her to just sort of like, because she was sort of her own MacGuffin in a way, in that they were looking for the original for so, so long. Turns out not only is she the original, but hey, guess what? It's someone we know and someone who's related to someone else. It's becoming almost as complicated as the Once Upon a Time family tree. I could totally imagine, if she wasn't connected to the family, for her to just sort of go off and live somewhere else and be a prominent character in season 5 when they bring everyone back, presumably. But because she was related to S, she kind of had to be there. So she was sort of involved in the action. And then once they say, like, OK, yeah, she's too powerful to not use as a game piece, Evie Cho decides to, you know, put her in that van. I mean, she gave them hell, and she, you know, was brave down to her final moments. But I don't know. I think she was brought in so late in the game in season 3 that she never made an impression on me, and she really didn't do so this season either.
Yeah, I mean, she was really pretty much a human MacGuffin. She was put there for people to react to her, to like get their sample out of her and then to react to her dying. And actually, though, I think that's the main reason I think we saw Felix go off the rails and distance himself from everybody at the beginning of the season, was because, oh, it turns out Sarah really is related to S, and that had to be the biggest blow.
Yeah, exactly, that he realized, like, oh, crap, I really am the odd man out, literally, in this case, in that I'm sort of just friends with a lot of people. I really have no big connections. Let me try to find my own family, though. He realized that, you know, his friends were his family all along, and everyone has a group hug, I'm assuming, that happened right off camera, maybe in an extended scene in one of these episodes.
Yeah, I mean, we must admit we were not watching After the Black all season.
Yeah, so. I do want to talk about that. I said I would watch After the Black after this episode, but my DVR might have glitched out on its own and not recorded it, and I can't seem to find the video online. Jess, did you watch After the Black after the finale?
Yeah, well, do you have Time Warner?
I do.
You should be able to get it on demand.
Okay, I'll try that afterwards, but you can spoil me all you want. How was After the Black, episode 10?
Actually, you know what? Forget I just said that. You don't need to see it. There were a couple of interesting factoids that they threw out there, mostly about like how they make the show, but nothing that really felt earth-shattering. And then at the end, the thing that I think soured me on After the Black for the rest of my life, at the end of the episode, the hosts that like to scream all the time, they said, "Hey, stay tuned. We got one more special thing. We got a blooper reel." And I'm like, "Oh, cool. Blooper reel. That should be fun to watch." It wasn't an Orphan Black blooper reel. It was an After the Black blooper reel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How self-serving was that? Hey, we had a lot of fun, and I know you guys did too, so here's some fun outtakes.
Yeah, and it was just basically like cast members sitting on stools, and half the time, like, I guess you can't get Tatiana every week, and since Tatiana is two-thirds of the cast, that poses a little problem with a show like this, but they would get their, it looked like they got the randomest actors. Like, they would get the, they had Dizzy on there at one point, and they had Duco the evil cop, and they had Allison's friend.
Yeah, I remember seeing, like, I was looking at pictures of After the Black smatterings, and it seemed like, yeah, a little bit of a random group in those middle episodes. You know, the big gets were obviously at the beginning and the end. So we'll issue a correction as well. I know after our premiere podcast, we're like, oh, this seems like a completely new thing. It's a new thing in the U.S. Apparently, you know, the show airs on a network called Space in Canada, and apparently they've been doing After the Black since season 3. So it's always been a thing. It's just been a thing in the USA, though. I'll admit, after seeing a couple of episodes of it, I don't know if Space necessarily wants to be proud of After the Black, because I find it entirely innocuous.
Yeah, Talking Dead, this is not.
Yeah, so what you would say then that this is sort of, on the whole spectrum, this is definitely more in the miss category than it is the hit from the couple episodes you've seen?
From the couple episodes I've seen, I really didn't think it added all that much. I mean, this is from a behind-the-scenes standpoint, this is a really interesting show, because you really do want to know how the sausage gets made, and the whole time you're watching thinking, like, well, how did they get, you know, how did they get Tatiana in the shot twice, and how did they make this look this way and that look that way? And it is interesting from that standpoint. And there are a few really great behind the scenes stories. And if you get Christian Bruin on there, he's great. Like, I could watch him talk all day. But for the most part, yeah, it's not. They don't have hosts that really want to shut up and let the cast talk. Like, the hosts have their own opinions that they want to get out there, and their opinions are not necessarily the most interesting.
I do want to bring up something that you talked about in your season premiere podcast, where you said you went to an interview recording at the 92nd Street Y, and you said that Christian Bruin slayed it, and that he had brought up something that you didn't want to say because it was a spoiler for the season. Can you reveal to us now what was the thing that Christian Bruin was talking about that you loved?
He was talking about, I believe he's talking about Donnie and Crystal.
Oh, okay. So that massage scene?
Yeah, the massage scene. He said it was his favorite thing they did all season.
Yeah, I mean, that was awesome. And it's, again, I think, you know, the perfect type of thriller action genre, in my opinion, is the stuff that mixes in the comedy as well. And I feel like, you know, Tatiana as Crystal and Donnie are just like a fantastic combination. I hope with Crystal officially joining Clone Club that we have even more opportunities to partner the two of them up moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, if we think Crystal is going to join Clone Club, I think she's going to be around a lot, but I don't think she's fully convinced she's a clone.
Yeah, exactly. She probably doesn't think that Clone Club should be the title of it, because to her, it should be like look-alike gang.
Yeah, and I don't even really look like these people.
That was great, because again, this is the first time her and Sarah had really seen each other. Her and Felix had interacted beforehand, but just have Sarah be the straight woman to this insanity, and to have Crystal, or Sarah as Crystal, pose as a TMZ paparazzi what we might think is ineffectively, but it turns out it completely works somehow, is great.
Yeah, it was pretty great. She adds a lot. I hope they figure out how to convince her to stick around.
Yeah, I think maybe they will. I think once her life is threatened, then she'll come back to the safety of her sisters. We got off the Beth train for a bit there, because I do want to ask, you know, we had surmised, okay, maybe we'll find out throughout the course of this season why Beth ultimately decided to commit suicide and what led her to those train tracks on that night. And we had sort of said maybe it was just aspects that were brought up in the first episode, but no, they very clearly fleshed out Beth's path to the train tracks, sort of culminating with Evie Cho getting her in a limo after Beth tries to take her out and says, you know, for the safety of your sisters, you need to take yourself out of the picture.
Yeah, and that was pretty heartbreaking because we never did. Like, it does seem like kind of a weird way, a weird place to start a series is by watching someone commit suicide and then never really going back to why that happened.
Yeah. I think it was nice. I don't think it was too heavy-handed. I liked the fact that, you know, they were looking at Beth's tapes, and then at the same time we were getting flashbacks of what Beth had been doing that night, you know, when she came home with blood on her hands, and they were wondering, okay, was that her, you know, going after Nia Lucian? But no, it was actually her going after Evie Cho, but she had, like, beaten the crap out of somebody else, and that was why her hands were bloody. It was just interesting to sort of connect the dots there. I mean, in terms of the flashback aspect, I know we were sort of either hot or cold on it used in episode one. Did you like that it was brought back sporadically throughout the season?
You know, I wasn't expecting to, but I really did. Like, I thought, you know, there had to be some things that Beth knew that she didn't share with the group. And what better way to bring everybody back full circle than to find out what those things were and to kind of dig into what they were and discover a little bit more about their, you know, departed Sestra.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only time when flashbacks doesn't work for me was when things are, like, too interesting in the present timeline. But I think because it was such a big mystery of what happened to Beth before she went to the train tracks in the past, I think, you know, acknowledging it was good. That being said, I hope they don't use too many more of them, that they rely on it as a crutch in terms of a trope, because, you know, we don't want the Jack's Tattoo equivalent of a flashback episode in Orphan Black, especially with only one season left.
I want the record to show that Mike was the one who brought up Lost first.
I mean, it's got to happen. I'm surprised I went this long without a Lost reference, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, because we had this mysterious island with others living on it.
Yeah, all right, so let's talk about that. Now that the Lost seal has been broken, I feel like we can let loose about the events that happened on this island. So this was a weird island to begin with, almost like the island of Dr. Moreau. Even Susan kind of refers to that tongue in cheek, where, you know, they're sort of just residing in this home, but obviously there's other stuff going on. Rachel's glitching out and seeing this kind of creepy old man looking at her with a swan with its head cut off. And then we find out that I at first thought it was a group of insurgents. They're probably less the insurgents as much as they now seem like the top tier of Neolution, headed by this guy, Westmoreland, who I guess is either Jacob or Richard Alpert, in that he is at least 100 years old and is doing fine.
Yeah, I totally flashed on Richard Alpert when they said that he'd been living on the island forever. And it was pretty interesting to me, like, you know, what's their relationship with Susan Duncan here? Are they paying her rent? Like, she doesn't seem to, you know, she's got this fancy house up on the hill. She obviously knows they're there, like, and they're all living in tents. This seems like a pretty big wealth inequality across the mysterious island. And I wonder, like, do they go to war with each other every so often? Do they share information? This is all a big blank.
Yeah, maybe they're like the others in that they're trying to give off the sense of poverty, but they really have, like, lush barracks hidden away in the bushes that they don't let anyone know about.
Yeah, I'm so glad nobody opened a hatch.
Just you wait. You never, maybe Westmoreland's in the hatch, and that's where he's just been pushing a button for the entirety of these four seasons to make sure that the clones keep living.
Oh, that's exactly what's going to happen, and now we're stuck watching it. But is Westmoreland, like, could he be the creepy old guy, or is he going to be some totally new guy?
I mean, I don't think it's the creepy old guy, because they made very clear that the creepy old guy was the messenger for Westmoreland. And it seems like Westmoreland is not very much about showing his face. Maybe it's because he doesn't want to reveal himself as the head of the organization. Maybe it's because he has a really weird, creepy face because he's at least 100 years old. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm pretty sure the guy who got sent, it's sort of like a Queen Amidala Padme type of situation.
Oh,
where,
okay.
And it took me that long to reference Star Wars, which I'm even more surprised about.
Yeah,
that.
But I brought up Star Wars first. So.
That's true. Yeah. So you broke the seal on that one. But it seems like there is a guy who's sort of doing the dirty work of Westmoreland, not necessarily masquerading as him, but he seems to be the one to kind of get everything done on the island.
Yeah, it could be one of these situations where we just got, like, this dude sitting behind the scenes letting everybody else do the interesting stuff. And I don't know that I care all that much at this point. I'm going to need a little bit more backstory on him before I'm invested.
Yeah. Do you think there's a chance that there might be anyone even higher than Westmoreland, or that there's a Man in Black, an equivalent to Westmoreland's Jacob, of like someone who's just as big as and powerful, who's been, you know, gunning for him the entire time?
I would say yes, if we knew for a fact that there were going to be more than one season left.
Yes.
Because, like I said, Turtle's all the way down. It's like, of course there's someone pulling his strings, and there's someone pulling that guy's strings for however many seasons it takes to get to the end. The princess is always in another castle.
Yeah, exactly. But now we've reached Bowser and the equivalent of Westmoreland. I agree what you said before about how it'll be intriguing to see why Delphine was chosen. Maybe it's because she was the head of Dyad and they saw, I don't know, they saw something in her, even though they were like, they were perched pretty precariously close to the scene of the incident, considering that they showed up, what, like a minute after Duco had been chased away?
Yeah, and we really need to talk about how they played fast and loose with time this episode. It's like, where is this island? Is this island in, like, Lake Superior? Because it sure seemed to me like they got there in a big hurry. Like, they got on and off that island in about 10 minutes every time.
Yeah, it seemed like that helicopter is just, you know, maybe Frank Lapidus was driving it, but it seemed to get pretty darn speedy going back and forth between the mainland and the island.
I think Peter Baelish was driving it. Yeah, like, that dude can teleport.
Do you think there's a chance, and I guess this will segue into season 5 talk in general, I mean, do you think there's a chance that, like, Dyad will be brought back into it, the Prolethians will be brought back into it, that we have this idea of what some shows do with final seasons, which is bringing back as many characters and storylines as possible? Or do you think they're going to try to streamline things more and say, okay, let's just concentrate on this new group of people?
Well, I think we've kind of closed the door on a lot of people. Like, it seems to me that we've at least, like, gathered them all together in one place, so we can say that, like, Proletheans are related to these guys. Like, Hutt guys and Neolutionists are one thing. We've already taken out Proletheans, we've taken out Dyad, we've pretty much wiped out Topside because we took all Ferdinand's money and then left him to be sexually humiliated. And all we got left are Hutt guys, and we got, like, the last shreds of Brightborn. It's all kind of, you know, together in this one stew, and we can finish cooking the stew, and then we can be done with the show.
Baby, you got a stew going on.
Exactly.
I thought at first you kept saying hot guys, and I'm like, I might not just not see the personal appeal in these people, because they all seem very grungy to me.
Yeah, really, there is kind of a dearth of hot guys on the show.
That's true, even though Cal's been gone. I did forget to bring up, we just talked about him a few minutes ago, Detective Duco. We talked about in episode 1 how, like, why does this guy look like he's an extra from Argo? He sticks out like a sore thumb. I mean, throughout the season, I had been calling him to myself, like, Detective Dicko, Detective Dumbass, Detective Creepo. He just never stuck for me. I was happy, you know, that he sort of got like a one episode dedicated to his entire death, and that they decide to vehemently target him, and that's when he had been talking to Allison, and he sort of had the half-assed backstory of, I guess, Evie had, like, threatened his niece, and so he decided to basically become her personal hitman. But did Detective Duco leave any sort of impression on you this season?
I kept not remembering his name. I kept calling him Danny Zuko.
He was going to sing about how his summer was so great in his big trench coat that happens to be leather.
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, this is another one of those cases of, you know, a bad guy needs to feel like he thinks he's in the morally right, and this guy really didn't. He's just like, I'm going to go kill people because that's what I do. And really, I thought the big creepy bald guy that hung out at Allison's house last season was way more compelling than this guy.
What did you think about, we saw those two EMS people in the first episode that turns out, you know, they were working for Neolution. And I think we thought, like, oh yeah, they're going to be the bad guys. What's the big story about them? But, like, we barely saw any of them for the rest of the season. Were you disappointed that sort of, I feel like Duco kind of stepped into their shoes of, like, the menacing henchmen?
Yeah, I think that's okay, because I think these guys, really, they had one job, and we could watch them do that one job several times over the course of the season, or we could just have them come back once and get killed that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about Sarah. I mean, we talked a little bit about what her storyline was this season. We talked about her fights with Felix, her bender that almost ended with her throwing herself onto the train tracks like Beth. Did you sense any significant growth or change in Sarah this season?
It seemed like Sarah kind of regressed this season. It felt like she was slipping back into the Sarah that she used to be before the Clone Club. And you saw her kind of abdicate responsibility for a big chunk of the season. But then you saw her step up again to be an even bigger badass. It was almost like she was a phoenix reinventing herself.
Yeah. Even though that phoenix got one of its wings brutally stabbed when, again, you know, you talk about
right Cosima. In the drumstick.
Exactly. Like, Cosima fell for the oldest trick in the book. Sarah kind of did, too, by saying, like, hey, I'm going to go to the island completely unarmed, thinking I can infiltrate it and go get Cosima back. And, oh, guess what, Sarah? Look where you are now. You are stabbed brutally in the leg and dying on a cold rock in the middle of, right near the beach, near the ocean.
Yeah, I'm sure she's going to get saved at the last minute, too. I'm sure the magic van is going to pull up and bring her to the tent city as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, though, because it seems like from what they were talking about, Westmoreland was not happy to see Cosima. So if Sarah is indeed brought to tent city and the hut guys, maybe she'll be sort of like a prisoner of war almost, in that Westmoreland will sort of, you know, keep her captive and not let her roam the camp and ask people any questions that she might want to.
Yeah, well, maybe there'll be a magical talking scorpion around to keep her company.
Oh, I miss that talking scorpion.
I do, too.
So speaking towards the season finale a little more as well, I mean, did you like Rachel's rise to power? We talk about throwbacks to season one. This was definitely one as well, where at the end of season one, Rachel is revealed to be a big person in Neolutionism and Dyad. And here she betrays her mother, stabs her in the front, but still stabs her nonetheless, and really shuts out the rest of her clone sisters to really become the big person and the head of the board with Neolutionism, and to be able to get her own one-on-one meeting with Westmoreland, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, good for Rachel. I'm going to go ahead and make a bold prediction. I don't think Rachel makes it out of season five alive.
Oh, I could definitely see that. But I could also might even make a bolder prediction and say that I could totally imagine like a thing where Sarah and Rachel go down together.
They do like the Harry Potter and Voldemort going over the cliff.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, a Gollum, you know, following Frodo's ring down into Mount Doom almost. Except, you know, Sarah's not just a finger. She's an entire person.
Yep.
It was interesting. You know, their rivalry had kind of been subsided for a couple seasons once Rachel was kind of out of the picture in season three. Once she became prominent again, they had a tenuous alliance. But here, this scene in the finale was really like a physical representation of the rivalry that they had, where it was almost like a horror movie where they were, you know, going, punching each other, stabbing each other, trying to shoot each other. It was brutal.
It really was one of the most physical confrontations I think we've ever seen on the show.
People on the show rarely like fight each other, it seemed, outside of, you know, what we see Helena doing to the drug kingpins off screen. But here was like a knock 'em out brawl in the middle of this island, and I think Sarah's gonna have a scar to remember that, both emotionally and physically, when she sees Rachel again.
Yeah, and can we talk about the fact that Rachel kept twisting wounds and poking at wounds?
Oh, yeah, she's a pretty big sociopath, even though she admits, I think, to Ferdinand earlier on when he finds her, she says, like, I'm not the same, I don't feel much of anything anymore. It's interesting to figure out how much of an arc she had in general. I mean, she got to see her mother again. Her mother unfortunately did leave her with those words basically of like, I wish you were never born. But I don't know how much character development Rachel had at the end of the day, considering that she was still power hungry enough to betray everyone she had literally just made an alliance with in order to secure herself a top spot at Neolutionism.
It's interesting to me as well. Like, I don't know. She started out not having very much of a conscience, and I think she must have quite a bit less of one at this point.
Yeah, she was gaining her strength in more ways than one. I think, you know, when she got stabbed in the eye with a pencil and went through that surgery and was bedridden for season three, she was kind of left as a frail child. But then as she sort of gained her ability to walk, she gained her inner strength again, and she was full Rachel by the end of this season.
Yeah, she's definitely back up to full Rachel.
So we talked about it a few times, Jess. It was announced before the season finale that next season of Orphan Black is going to be its last. First of all, what do you think are the causes behind it? And second of all, are you happy? Are you sad? Are you indifferent, a la Ira? Let me hear your thoughts.
Well, honestly, I think, you know, I'm going to be sad about it because obviously I love the show. I enjoy the characters, I enjoy the performances, but really there's a point at which the show could have gone on for far too long with far too many new enemies that wouldn't end up making a whole lot of sense in the end. And to give it an end date gives them an opportunity to wrap up the major conundrums they've been facing, you know, the show's been facing the whole time. We can resolve that, we can tie up those loose ends, and we can still make it feel like, you know, they're going off into the sunset. They have, you know, more avenues to explore that we don't necessarily need to see. And they don't need to fight any more, like, big enemies working for big corporations or science firms or clubs where people have tails or whatever the hell else they've been throwing at us for these last four seasons. Let's give it one more season. Let's not introduce any new huge wrinkles. Let's tie those ends up. Let's give everybody a good send-off. And that's all you can hope for. It's much, much better than either going on for eight seasons or getting canceled after three.
So I was trying to do this research, but I couldn't necessarily find a source for it. Was it a creator decision or was it a network decision? Because I don't know how the ratings were. I don't know if they're fantastic. I'm assuming the move to Thursday nights might not have helped it, considering that it ran on Saturday for three seasons before that. But it'd be interesting to know, like, is this a Community or is this a Breaking Bad in terms of how the final season will be handled?
Well, it's never been a high performer. Like, there have not been, like, this doesn't have a huge dedicated viewer base. This is no Walking Dead. This is no Breaking Bad in terms of what kind of audience it gets. But the audience it does get is so, so engaged. Like, they're, you know, there was a list recently. I read an article that was listing the TV shows that had the most podcasts available about them. And the top 10, Orphan Black makes the top 10 despite having an audience that's, you know, a 20th the size of some of the other shows. Like, obviously Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, high up there. There was one non-scripted show on there, and we could probably guess what that was. But Orphan Black shows up in there, and the authors of the article were even surprised, because who watches Orphan Black? People that really love the show. There are some 50 podcasts out there of their people just like us talking about Orphan Black, which is probably why we took a step back this season. We'll let the other 49 people deal with it. But they have such a devoted following, and like I said at the beginning of the season when I went to the talk at the 92nd Street Y, I thought I was an Orphan Black fan. It turns out I'm just someone that watches the show because I saw the true fans there. And I think those people deserve to see this show seen through to a logical conclusion and not dragged out until it whimpers across the finish line.
The only thing that honestly makes me sad about this season, this series ending after season five, is the fact that this is honestly probably going to be Tatiana Maslany's roles of a lifetime. And just the fact that, like, this feat that happens every week on television will not be happening anymore after season five is sad. Because I honestly, you know, when I talk to people about Orphan Black, I say, like, you know, I think season one is a must see. I think, you know, the other seasons are very good. But honestly, if you watch it for anything, just watch for the job that Tatiana Maslany is doing, because in my opinion, she is doing one of the greatest acting jobs on television right now. It's, as we even saw, as we talked about before with Ari Millen, it is such an immensely tough thing to do, to play multiple characters and to give them completely different personalities and to play them well. It's literally five times the work that any other actor is doing on TV. And so I'm saddened that we are depriving both her and the audience, the general television viewing audience, of the opportunity to see this circus act go on for more seasons.
Yeah, but I mean, how long could it go on, really?
No, I agree. I think I completely agree with what you said before. If it went on for more seasons, you know, we had said before our least favorite parts of Orphan Black are when they say, oh no, it's not this person that's behind it, it's this person, but not just this person, this person's also pulling the strings of this person. And I feel like if you went on for more seasons, it would just get more and more of that and more and more and more convoluted. And, you know, we don't want any shows to really drag on for too long. So I'm personally happy that they said, let's cut it off at season five. I thought season four was a very good season. I hope season five can only escalate from there and, you know, maybe even surpass season one, depending on what they decide to do. I feel like this is also one of the first finales that really left things on a bit of a cliffhanger, in that, you know, Sarah is wounded. Cosima is, albeit fine for right now, but A, she's dying. B, she's in the company of someone who does not like her. And both of these people are pretty much prisoners at this point. There are no things that are wrapped up with a neat, tiny little bow except for Evie Cho and Detective Duco. Everything else is kind of out in the open, which makes season 5 very exciting in terms of prospects.
Yeah, it's true. They've got some place to go. And when they get there, it's an okay stopping point.
Yeah. Absolutely. Jess, is there anything else you want to talk about with Orphan Black season 4?
I can say there was one thing that disappointed me a little bit, and that was that we didn't get another fantastic moment of everybody all in one place. Like, we didn't get a family dinner, we didn't get a dance party, and I was really hoping to see that, because I didn't know what they would throw at us this season. So it would be really nice if the final moment we get at the end of season 5 is something really epic with everybody together in one place like that.
Yeah, and maybe it's because the season started with Sarah off in another country. Because even season 3, even though it didn't have the dinner, and it even started the season with the big Helena dream sequence where they were in suburbia. But I guess it was because everyone kind of started scattered to the winds. It was tough for them to really get back together all at once. But yeah, I miss those moments as well because, you know, as much as we may disparage the clone dance party, I think those moments are still really fun. And again, it's fantastic to just think about this is one person playing all four of the characters that are on screen right now.
And I think she's going to go on to do great things, but they're never going to be quite as weird and awesome as this.
Yeah. And, you know, for season 3, Tatiana Maslany was nominated for an Emmy. I hope tradition repeats itself in season 4, and who knows, maybe if the Emmy gods are smiling down upon us, she will walk away with that trophy come September.
I don't think anybody works harder for it.
Yep, I completely agree with that.
Yeah, so I think this is a terrific place to close the book on season 4.
The giant Westmoreland book on Orphan Black season 4?
Yes, with the creepy spawn drawings.
Yes, exactly. I didn't know why those were in there, but you know what? Westmoreland, we haven't met him yet. Maybe he's got his OMO, it seems.
Maybe his endgame involves, like, creepy shit with swans.
Oh, God. If they went in that direction, I don't know how I'd feel about season 5.
I'd be glad it was ending. All right, so do we have a hashtag?
I'd be intrigued to know other listeners' thoughts about Delphine as a character. So we use the term Delfan before, D-E-L-F-A-N. So if you want to use the hashtag either Delfan or no Delfan, just to let us know what you think about Delphine and if you agree with our assessments of her.
I think that's great. I will be looking forward to the feedback. And as always, you can leave your feedback in the form of comments over on postshowrecaps.com, or you can tweet at us. I am at Haymaker Hattie.
And I am at a Mike Bloom type. And Jess, we talked about prison before. I know you are going to start diving into some coverage of a certain other type of prison-based show on Post Show Recaps, right?
Yes, indeed. I apparently do all the shows that start with O and end in black. Taylor Cotter and I will be recapping Orange is the New Black. And we recorded our first episode yesterday, and we've got plans to do the next 3 or 4 tomorrow. And it's going to be a great season. So I hope if you are fans of that, once you complete your binge watch, you'll tune in to postshowrecaps.com and check us out there.
Yeah, I was telling Jess before we came on, I had watched the first episode before recording this. I enjoyed it. Jess had alluded to me the fact that there's a moment later on in the season that is quite buzzworthy. So I'm remaining firmly in the dark for now, trying to not reveal myself to too many spoilers. But I'm excited for the season. And I'm even more excited to hear you and Taylor cover Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun so far, and I'm very excited to talk to her about what happens next. Okay, so I think with all of that, we can thank everybody for tuning in.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for tuning in, listening to us cover the premiere and the finale. I know, as Jess said before, we dialed back our coverage, but I think it was still a lot of fun. Thank you, Jess, for coming on and sitting down and nerding out about Orphan Black with you. And I'll again thank you once more for, you know, coming up to me 2 years ago and saying watch Orphan Black, because it's a decision I do not regret, and I'm thrilled to hopefully cover Orphan Black in some capacity for the final season as well. But again, thank you guys out there for listening to the podcast and letting us know your thoughts on the season as well.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my advice, Mike.
Of course, I'm gonna take now. I feel like you're my prophet. I'm gonna go to you for all my television show recommendations from now on.
All right, well, I'll make a list for you.
Perfect. I love this. The least list.
That's the least list. All right, so thanks again, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll see you next season.